Hey, this is Leo for Actualized.org, and in this episode, I'm going to be talking about becoming a Zen devil, the dangers of half-assing enlightenment. If you cannot weep with a person who is crying, there is no Kensho. A quote by Yamada Koun. For a while now, I've wanted to address this problem and the dangers that I see with Neo-Advaita. Neo-Advaita. What is this exactly? Well, it's this tendency in the West, especially in modern times, to basically say, okay, we've got this thing called non-duality. Great. So let's take a look at all these different traditions we've got. Christian non-duality, Islamic non-duality, the Buddhist non-duality, Hindu non-duality. That's what Advaita, Neo-Advaita is. Regular Advaita is just basically a school of Indian non-duality. So what happens is that people see that and they say, well, there's all this bad stuff with religion. There's all this kind of traditional, ritualistic stuff, all these beliefs and dogmas. So, you know, we're very advanced here in the West. So what we're going to do in our infinite wisdom is we're going to take the techniques and strip all the spiritual traditions of any adornments or any belief systems and just take the techniques. So we'll take, for example, Advaita Vedanta. We'll strip it of all its cultural baggage. We'll bring it to the West. And now we'll just teach a very direct method for enlightenment. And what could possibly go wrong with that? This is a tendency that we see here in the West, in America and in Europe. And generally speaking, I'm kind of two opinions about this trend. I think that, in a sense, it's good. Because some of the traditional baggage that comes with these techniques and core teachings about non-duality is quite frankly outdated and unnecessary. But it can lead to problems. There are dangers. And that's what I'm going to talk about here. So before we get to that, though, I want to really drive this point home by talking about Mount Hiei, the founding of Mount Hiei in Japan. This is one of the most hardcore non-dual schools and traditions that exists. And it still exists today, even though it was founded over 1,000 years ago. So here's a little backstory about Mount Hiei. This is where you find the marathon monks of Mount Hiei, if you've heard me talking about that before in my Strong Determination Sitting video. So Mount Hiei is a mountain near Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan. And back when Zen was first getting started, and there were multiple schools of Zen, there was a guy by the name of Saicho, who was one of the first people who wanted to found a monastic order on the mountain of Hiei. He was a very upstanding, principled guy, and he was very serious and very scholarly. So what he actually did to ensure that the Japanese have a Zen tradition is he actually traveled by ship on a perilous journey all the way to China. This was in 800 AD, roughly speaking. He traveled to China. He spent years in China learning from the greatest Chan masters, learning about Buddhism, learning about Taoism, learning about the Chinese forms of Zen, gathering hundreds, if not thousands, of scriptures, reading them, translating them, understanding them, and then bringing them all back to Kyoto in Japan, and then starting his school in Mount Hiei. He actually died before the school was really built. But after him, then he had students who took on the lineage, and they founded Mount Hiei with many hundreds of temples there where they practiced Zen very hardcore. So what I want to do is I want to read to you an excerpt from a book that mentions the history of Mount Hiei, because this is very illuminating, and this really drives the point home about Zen devilry. So here it is. Quote, temples began to conduct trade and establish commercial concerns to increase the size of their treasuries. Each large temple functioned as more or less an independent entity and engaged large numbers of assistant priests and lay brothers to maintain and protect their establishment. Attracted by the promise of free food and lodging, the ranks of the temple aides and lay workers were rapidly infiltrated by vagabonds, brigands, and eventually mercenaries. Contrary to the strict injunctions of Saicho, who was dead by this point, horses, cattle, and weapons were now provisioned on Mount Hiei, and each monastic faction on the mountain organized its own militia, justifying such armed forces as absolutely necessary to protect Buddhism from its enemies. As each faction strove to improve its fortunes and consolidate its position, conflicts arose between rival gangs, and attacks and violent reprisals became commonplace. Buildings were constantly being torched, and the entire mountain turned into one large camp. There were disputes over territorial claims, funds, selection of officials, and even fights over who had precedence in bathing in the monastic bathhouses. During the turbulent medieval period, some of the abbots were in office only a day or two before being ousted by one faction or another. Hiei marauders took on the temple armies and ruthlessly attacked any new Buddhist sect that dared to attempt to establish itself, even though nearly all the leaders of these new schools were originally the same Hiei monks. They turned on their former comrades in arms and burned every one of their sect's temples in Kyoto to the ground, in the process slaughtering every adherent they could lay their hands on. The Nichiren sect in Kyoto never recovered from that blow. By the middle of the 15th century, an internal corruption of Hiei, the first training site in Japan to have banned alcohol and all sexual activity, was now overrun with drunkards, sodomites, rapists, and whores. And finally, in 1571, a battalion of 25,000 of the emperor's troops unleashed a furious assault on the mountain fortress in Hiei, torching all the buildings and massacring the inmates. The conflagration lit up the sky for 3 days and three nights, and the ashes of some 3,000 temples blanketed the capital. End quote. That's from John Stevens's books, from John Stevens' book, The Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei, where he goes into a lot of depth about this incredible history of Zen and this specific form of Zen found on this mountain. Now, why do I mention this? Well, because take a look at what's going on. Take a look at the meta picture. These guys here, these were not just random guys just doing some fluffy form of spirituality. These were serious practitioners. They were very serious about becoming enlightened. And some of them were enlightened. And yet, look at the chaos and carnage that resulted on that mountain. What this demonstrates is a lack of understanding of history, human psychology, and systems thinking. And this is just one of the traps that can happen to you on this path of non-duality. See, people think when I teach non-duality, sometimes I hear this. And I'm noticing this trend of people who follow me are espousing this very simplistic notion of enlightenment as though there's just this one insight. There's just one existential insight to be had. And then bam, as soon as I have that insight, then that's it. That's the end of seeking. That's the end of illusion, that's the end of everything. That's the end of personal development. There's no more need to improve myself. There's no more need to learn. There's no more need to do any of this kind of stuff. And that is just like, bam, it's just that simple. But that's a very simplistic notion of enlightenment. What I want to point out to you is that enlightenment is a little bit more nuanced than that. And in fact, if you have any common sense, you should expect it to be a little bit more nuanced than that. Because if it was just that damn simple, then we wouldn't have all the complexity, nuance, and richness that we find in all the various mystical traditions around the world. Some of these schools are very elaborate, almost Byzantine in their rituals, in their prescriptions, in their practices, in their techniques, in their teachings, in their theory, in their concepts of cosmology in the world. Now, you might think that, oh, well, all of that is just tradition and dogma, and we don't need any of that. But then that actually leads you to the opposite end of the negative spectrum. So I hear you, you want to move away from the dogma and the tradition. Okay. But then if you swing your pendulum too much to the other side, then you get the Zen devil. And this is where people think that, oh, okay, so there's just one monolithic enlightenment experience. And then once I have that, that means no more values, no more principles, no more passion, no more pursuit of mastery, no more goals, no more purpose, no more vision, no more career, no more business, no more relationships, no more pursuit of excellence, no more education, no more hard work, no more thinking, no more planning, no more strategizing, no more caring. And if you are interpreting non-duality in that fashion, that's a very naive understanding of non-duality. If you take a look and you do a broader survey of the history and the various mystical traditions, as I encourage you to do, then what you will see is that the greatest masters have very strong principles, very strong values, enormous passion, a commitment to mastery, a commitment to excellence. They're very hardworking. They make plans and goals. They don't just sit around on their ass. They're not lazy. They're not slobs. They're not slovenly. They conduct business. They engage the world. They care about society. They care about ecology. They care about relationships. And in general, they're very caring individuals. Enlightenment doesn't make you less caring. It should make you more caring. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're doing enlightenment in the Zen devil way. And really, an individual who thinks like this, this kind of simplistic notion of enlightenment, to me, it shows that they've never been face to face with a great master. And I can understand that. Great masters can be hard to find. But you know what? They do exist right now. In the 21st century, you can find them. And I've found various ones, and I've been face to face with them. It's one thing to read about enlightenment in a book somewhere. It's another thing to actually be in front of a master. Because this thing, this non-duality thing, is not a book learning thing. It's embodied. And it's not even you sitting on a meditation cushion and having some amazing, brilliant insights into the nature of reality. I mean, it is that, but it's a lot more than just that. And you can only sense that and appreciate it when you meet a great master face to face. It's a remarkable thing. I mean, could you imagine if you've read anything about Zen and Zen temples and how strict the Zen tradition is? Could you imagine that you're a monk in a Zen temple and you've been there, you've been on the cushion working towards enlightenment, and then all of a sudden you have a big breakthrough enlightenment experience? And then the next day, you know, they ring the gong to wake up at 4 a.m. to meditate. You only sleep for like 4 to 5 hours every night. It's a pretty grueling schedule. And you're meditating long hours, and then you're working in the kitchen, and then you're cleaning the temple and doing all this stuff. Could you imagine that they ring the gong at 4 a.m.? Everyone's getting up, and you're like, nah, you know, guys, I got enlightened last night. Why should I be waking up at 4 a.m.? Waking up at 4 a.m., I mean, that's for the unenlightened people. I'm enlightened, so I'm going to sleep in till like noon, and then I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to go eat whatever I want. I'm going to order a pizza, drink some soda. Maybe we can get some vodka in here. You know, then I'm going to go, I think I'm going to go out, maybe go hit on some girls. You know, it doesn't matter. After all, I've realized all this is just an illusion, so I can play the game however I want. Can you imagine that kind of insolence in a Zen temple? What would they do to you? They would beat you. They would physically beat you and throw you out of the temple. Or could you imagine that you become enlightened, then you come to your master and you say, oh, okay, that's it. I'm enlightened now. So no more. I don't need to meditate anymore. I don't need to do anything anymore. The master would probably slap you in the face if you said that. Or could you imagine coming up to your master and saying, oh yeah, I had this most amazing enlightenment experience. I don't need to study anymore. I don't need to read the books. I don't need to read the scriptures. I don't need to care about any of that kind of stuff. Again, he would slap you in the face. In fact, you wouldn't even get that far. Because when you're face to face with a great master, just the way he looks at you, it's like a wolf looking at a rabbit. All right? You are in no position to espouse this sort of philosophy of nothing matters anymore. There's no further to go. There's no more room for growth. Values go out the window. I can just be slovenly and lazy. You know, I'm walking through the Zen temple and I'm smoking a cigarette, and then I'm just going to throw that cigarette into their sand garden. Can you imagine that? They would beat you for that. They would beat you and kick you out. Now, someone might say, but Leo, all this stuff, you know, yeah, it might be true, but you're talking about Zen. Zen is, after all, a religion. It's very strict and ritualized. And it seems like what you're doing here is you're idolizing. You're talking about these masters as though they're these, like, you're putting them on a pedestal, like they're these super enlightened people that we can never aspire to be. No. Yes, it's true that in Zen, there is ritual and there is dogma and there's religious elements and there's tradition. And you know what? I'm one of the most anti-traditional guys you'll find out there. I don't really like tradition for tradition's sake. But I've studied enough. I see enough of the big picture of how mysticism works that I can see that there's wisdom in tradition. Not all tradition is just tradition for tradition's sake. There's actually a lot of very deep wisdom embedded in it. So when you throw out all tradition, the way Neo-Advaita tends to do, and all you do is you go for the most straight, direct method for existential insights. Okay, that's great. I like that idea. But you can't throw out the other important stuff like strong principles, ethics, having a good character, emotional development, and so forth. Otherwise, you're going to become a Zen devil, and you're going to lead to a lot of chaos and damage. That's what's going to happen. These masters, I don't put them on a pedestal. I don't subscribe to any one master. But what I do is I recognize skill and excellence wherever I see it. Whether I'm watching an amazing movie by some amazing director, or I'm reading an amazing book, or I'm looking at an amazing piece of art, I can recognize the excellence there. That doesn't mean I need to put the person on some sort of pedestal as above me in any existential sense, but I do see that, man, this guy has really gone to some remarkable lengths to master this field, and that's amazing, and there's something valuable there, whether it's non-duality or any other kind of field, right? This is just caring about excellence and caring about mastery. Here's an important distinction that I want you to make. Small non-duality versus big non-duality. You might say, well, Leo, how can there be two non-dualities? After all, it's just non-duality. How come you're subdividing it? Here's what practically tends to happen. Is that when people first learn about non-duality and they have a few non-dual experiences, they get cocky. And what they do is they pit non-duality against duality. And so what this does is this creates a new higher level of duality, veiled as non-duality. As you would expect, you know, someone who doesn't have a lot of maturity and a lot of depth of experience and mastery, they might be able to play a good game of tennis, or they might be able to beat you at martial arts, but they're not masterful at it. And also, they've got these subtle signs of cockiness. So small non-duality is a sort of non-duality that pits itself against other schools of non-duality. So there's rivalry, there's nitpicking and criticizing. there's a tendency to weaponize the lessons that you learn and then try to use them against others to make others feel inferior and to make yourself feel superior. And it's also a separation. It's not a full integration yet of the dual and the non-dual. So to appreciate this, you have to understand what big non-duality looks like. And it's really hard to understand big non-duality unless you actually see it embodied in a master. This is what the master is about. Big non-duality, it's humble. It's deeply humble. It understands and integrates non-duality and duality both. You see? It's got both of them because big non-duality is so non-dual that even the dual stuff, the mundane stuff that a small non-dual person would poo-poo, it embraces it because it sees that the good and the evil in the world, even though it's not existentially true, it's still there and it's still a part of the world on a practical level. It's also generous. Big non-duality, you don't see a big non-duality practitioner going out there and waging ideological crusades or nitpicking or criticizing other teachers, whether they're of the non-dual tradition or even of the dual tradition. A big non-duality individual will take a look at techniques and methods that have nothing to do with non-duality, just maybe some basic self-help techniques. And he might say, oh, you know what? Yeah, I can see a room for that. I can see a place for therapy. Therapy could be useful. I can see a place for working on your career, and I can see a place for working on your bad habits, this kind of basic generic self-help type stuff. I can see a place for that. All of that lays the groundwork and prepares you and introduces you to the deeper spiritual work. Whereas a small non-dual individual will say, oh, no, all that's nonsense. All of it's illusion. Everything's illusion. Just go straight for enlightenment. Not realizing that some people can't go straight for enlightenment. It might take them a decade to work themselves up to that. You see? So big non-duality is much more inclusive. It's less combative. And this might have been the key difference that led to the chaos on Mount Hiei versus there not being any chaos there, right? Had the people there truly been embodying big non-duality, which is a rare thing, it takes a lot of years of mastery. If they really embodied that, then maybe that chaos could have been avoided. So I keep talking about the Zen devil. This is a phenomenon. And in Zen, it's called Zen Tema, T-E-M-M-A. And it's defined as one who has the experience of Satori, or enlightenment, but has done no scholarly study of the literature. That's a Zen devil. They also have a concept called Wild Fox Zen, or Yako Zen, Y-A-K-O, Yako Zen. This is the opposite end of the spectrum. So on this end, we have someone who sits and meditates all day, but doesn't expand his broader knowledge of the world. That's Zen devil. And that leads to chaos and problems. And on this end, we have the Wild Fox Zen, which is someone who does the opposite. Someone who only reads the books and knows the theory of Zen, but has no practice and hasn't had any of the insights. And this also leads to a lot of problems. And so ideally what you want is you want to walk right in the middle of those two. And both of those extremes are going to lead to problems, right? So when I hear people saying, oh, Leo, you know, after enlightenment, I don't need to study anymore. I don't need to do personal development anymore. To me, that's ridiculous. That shows me that that person is going to become a Zen devil, and all the chaos that comes with being a Zen devil is going to come out from that. It's going to be a half-assed enlightenment. If you still doubt me, just use common sense here. Common sense will tell us that we have something called the 10,000-hour rule. The 10,000-hour rule says that to master any field, a human being needs to invest at least 10,000 hours into that field, if not more. I don't care if you're talking about golf, art, music, running a business, becoming a successful politician, or non-duality. All of it requires you to obey the 10,000-hour rule for mastery. Now, ask yourself, just using very basic common sense, why would non-duality be an exception to this rule? Why is it special? What I want to suggest is that it's not special. And that, in fact, the field of non-duality is the most serious field to master. It requires even more than the 10,000-hour rule to really master and embody it. Otherwise, how do you explain why virtually all the greatest masters of non-duality, no matter what tradition they're from, have over 10,000 hours of training? How else do you explain why every mystical tradition for the last 5,000 years, whether it be Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Kabbalist, or Islamic, that all of them have extremely hardcore training disciplines? These guys would make an Olympic athlete training schedule look amateur. That's how hard they go at it. Yogis and monks and nuns and sages have been training for decades. Dozens of hours a day. A dozen hours a day for decades, right? They've really been working on this. And they have some very hardcore and brutal training techniques. If you doubt that, go read up on the Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei. What they do seems impossible. What they do seems superhuman. Why do they go through all that? Is it just because they are masochists and they enjoy torturing and flagellating themselves? Is that why they do it? Is it just because of religious tradition? Is it just dogma? Is that why they do it? Or could it be that there's something very valuable at the end of that mastery road, and that's why they do it, and that there really is a lot of stuff to learn about non-duality beyond merely having a few enlightenment insights? Could that be the case? Interesting to think about. You might wonder, well, Leo, what more could there be to non-duality or to spirituality than just some enlightenment experiences? There's a lot more. A lot more. First of all, there's different depths of enlightenment. And there's a whole spectrum and variety of different enlightenment experiences. So you might think like, well, okay, Leo, yeah, I can see how, you know, developing some good character and developing compassion and love, yeah, sure, that should be part of the non-dual path. But you're not saying that there's actually like different degrees of enlightenment, are you? That wouldn't make any sense. After all, we're talking about non-duality. Non-duality is just this one thing. It's one monolithic thing. And what I'm telling you is, yes, developing character is important. But even beyond that, if you don't take on the full mastery path, you're not going to have the deepest levels of consciousness and existential understanding. You will not. Your enlightenment will be shallow, existentially speaking, not even speaking practically. You will not really understand what reality is all about. That's highly likely. It's very rare that somebody becomes fully enlightened in one moment. Just like, bam, it happened. That's it. I'm fully enlightened. All right, let's go home and watch cartoons and eat pizza. We're done here. That's extremely rare. Extremely rare. I don't even know if it ever has happened like that. Sometimes in the myths, if you go back and you read 1,000-year-old myths, you might read examples of that happening. But if you look a little bit deeper, it doesn't tend to happen that way. It doesn't seem that way. Right? The Buddha spent 6 or 7 years in rigorous training and practice to get to the point where he did have his enlightenment. And even that, I don't know. Did he really have a full enlightenment in one go? or then did he spend many years deepening it? Keep your mind open to that possibility. Also, keep your mind open to the possibility that there are other insights that aren't perhaps as earth-shaking as a full enlightenment into the nature of who you are and what reality is, but there might be other more minor insights which are still very important and relevant and very interesting and fascinating and worth your while to have. I'll talk more about that in the future, but for now, keep your mind open to it. So if all you do is you go for this one monolithic enlightenment thing, you find out what you are, but then you're missing all these other minor insights. That would be a shame. Also, what more there is to enlightenment is emotional mastery. This is a huge component. In fact, probably the biggest component of enlightenment is not the having of an enlightenment insight, but then the bringing it down and letting it transform your entire mind structure and your emotional reactions and patterns, changing all of that. That takes a lot of time and a lot of work, and it doesn't happen spontaneously and automatically the way that naively some people expect. This is probably one of the biggest traps that creates Zen devils and all their chaos, is they think that just because they saw something that now, oh, I'm a master, and that's it, there's nothing more to do. And then they run amok in the real world. Then you have all sorts of problems, like they become greedy, power hungry, leads to sexual abuse, to stealing, to all sorts of unethical behavior, because they haven't really mastered their shadow side. They haven't done any shadow work. They've dismissed psychology as unimportant because they've made the mistake of thinking that, oh, now that I've experienced the transcendent absolute truth and I've transcended my mind, that solves all the problems. But it doesn't, because you know what? You have to come back into your mind. Your mind has to integrate and bring back down to earth this very lofty existential insight. And then you're back in the everyday world. And your mind, it doesn't change instantly. You have a brain in here. All those neurons have to rewire. And that's, in some cases, way harder than just breaking through to enlightenment. What more there is to enlightenment is unconditional love and the cultivation of that love in all situations. That's extremely difficult to do. And that takes much more additional work. Relationships are another facet of enlightenment. Learning how to have enlightened relationships with people. The bad patterns that you learned throughout your entire childhood and adulthood until you became enlightened, those bad habits in your relationships will carry over and they will still remain even after you've become enlightened. So you're going to have to work on your relationships if you want to have successful ones, ones where you don't abuse and manipulate people, take advantage of them and so forth. If you want to have a marriage, if you want to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and you want to make that work, if you want to have good relations with your children, you're going to have to work on all that. Also, all your other negative bad habits, your drinking habit, your prescription medication habit, your bad eating habit, especially in Western society, we have all these negative habits. So one of the real dangers of Neo-Advaita is that you forget about this and you have a breakthrough into existential truth. And then you come back, and because you're in a very toxic Western culture, all these bad habits you had, they're still there. You can transcend the mind, but the mind still will run the body. Yeah, you see? And those patterns of how your mind runs the body, those could be very negative and destructive. Also, what more there is to enlightenment is education. There's a lot to learn about the world. Sure, you could be enlightened about the ultimate truth of God and existence, but then you're ignorant about a great many things. You can't point to Pakistan on the map. Or you don't know about politics. Or you go voting for the wrong president, and then that leads to a nuclear holocaust, right? Education does matter. That's important. Everything that you try to do in the practical, mundane world requires knowledge, technical skills, and understanding. And you're not going to solve that problem by just experiencing existential absolute truth. What else is important is being a good citizen. And also community is very important. It's possible that you become enlightened, but then you're not a good citizen. And you don't give a shit about the community. And then your community turns into the kind of hellhole that Mount Hiei became, where everyone is running around raping each other, right? Or you're not contributing to the community. Or you're not caring about the community. All these things are important things. To say that, oh, I'm enlightened and I'm living in this dream, everything's an illusion, so fuck the community. I don't give a fuck about the community. That just shows you how little enlightenment you actually embody on a day-to-day basis. Having an ethical career is important, too. Just because you're enlightened and then you're working at a slaughterhouse or you're working on Wall Street or you're working in politics or you're working somewhere else where you're causing a lot of damage to the ecology, to the community, to your society, to the world. This is not cool. This is not cool. You're going to want to have a career where you're contributing in a positive, conscious manner to the world and helping the world and your community raise its level of consciousness. You're going to want that. And if you're missing that component, that's going to create suffering for you. And also, it's just not going to be part of a real commitment to non-duality, you see? A commitment to non-duality is not just to know non-duality. It's to embody it. Transcending your culture is also going to be an important part. Just because you're enlightened does not mean you've transcended your culture. There can be a lot of negative, nasty things about your culture which you can still be perpetuating. For example, if you live in a racist culture, then you might still be an enlightened racist. Now, that might sound paradoxical. Like, Leo, how can one be an enlightened racist? But actually, think about it. These racist tendencies have been programmed into your brain, physically programmed, from your birth for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Then you become enlightened, you see existential truth, but those bad habits and that programming is still in there. That needs to be unwired. It's not going to happen spontaneously of its own. See, you have to make an effort. And also, there's many limitations to culture, so it's not just like racism, but you might become an ideological crusader, where now you think that your culture is the best culture because, let's say, you use your cultural techniques to become enlightened, then you try to force every other culture to transform and to buy into your culture. Otherwise, you attack and you criticize them. That could certainly be something that happens to you if you don't engage in this effort to become more multicultural, more worldly, more cosmopolitan in your understanding of all the different mystical traditions, as I talked about last week. Transcending of various ideologies is also very important. Just because you're enlightened does not mean you don't have ideological biases and dogmas. And letting those go, again, that can be tricky. What more is there to enlightenment? There's your physical health, taking care of your physical body, making sure it's well nourished, making sure you're getting the right nutrition and exercise. There's developing good character. Morals and ethics matter. There's ecology, concern for the environment, concern for the globe, concern for other beings that are not human, for animals, for plant life, and so forth. There's also spiritual powers that one can develop. There's actually a lot more to spirituality than just non-duality, and I'll talk specifically about that in the future. But there's all sorts of interesting spiritual powers and various phenomena that you can experience, you can use to help heal people, to help teach people better, to help to understand people, and so forth. Some people go really deep down that rabbit hole. And lastly, I would say there's understanding. I would say that understanding is even more important than enlightenment. Because, yeah, you can have this one insight into the absolute nature of things. And that, of course, gets you a lot of understanding about the world. That's important. But there's more to understanding than just that. it's hard for me to express how much richer and more enjoyable the insights that I have had, the existential insights that I have had, when I can put them into a broader perspective and context in my understanding of business, society, history, humanity, evolution, science, cosmology, physics, biology, physiology, you know, putting all that stuff together is so much more rich than just having a direct insight into who and what you are. I mean, that's important. Don't get me wrong. That's important. But there's more to understanding than just that. There's a bigger perspective here for you to have. So what I want to do now is I want to quote you from another book, which drives this point home about the importance of psychology in pursuing non-duality. It says, quote, post-Satori practice for Hakuin, and Hakuin was one of the revivers of the Rinzai Zen school. So for Hakuin, post-Satori practice meant finally ceasing to be preoccupied with his own personal condition and attainment, and to devote himself and his practice to helping and teaching others. Finally, at long last, he realized that true enlightenment is a matter of endless practice and compassionate functioning, and not something that occurs once and for all in one great moment on the cushion. Non-duality, especially as it's developed in 21st century America, runs the risk of emotional bypass, of imagining that deep-seated emotional problems and character pathology can be washed away solely by sufficiently deep realization without ever having to engage psychological problems directly. Not only did realization fail to heal deep divisions in our character, more and more it looked as if for many people, and in particular for many Zen teachers, practiced opened up bigger and bigger splits between an idealized compassionate self and the shadow self, where split off and denied sexual, competitive, and narcissistic fantasies held sway. End quote. And that's from a book called Nothing is Hidden by Barry Magid. So here he talks about some of the pitfalls of being overly focused on just the non-dual aspects of this path. A lot of people don't realize that being a good person is separate from enlightenment. And you might say, well, Leo, why should I be a good person? After all, good and bad is just duality. It's just an illusion. But see, again, this is a small non-dual way of thinking. A large non-dual way of thinking understands that, yes, good and bad are relative. They may not be existentially true, but nevertheless, that doesn't mean they aren't important. Because non-duality includes duality in it. See? Otherwise, by your logic, why do anything? Why wake up in the morning? Why tie your shoelaces? Why drink water? Why eat food? Why wipe your ass after you take a crap? And for that matter, why become enlightened in the first place? Why? I mean, it's all just an illusion. Doesn't matter. Does it matter that you became enlightened? No, doesn't matter. Enlightenment says it doesn't matter that you became enlightened. But that's not what you actually act like. You don't really have a choice in the matter unless you kill yourself. You know, if you want to become enlightened and kill yourself, okay, fine. But otherwise, you're still alive in this world. You're still here until you're dead. And you have to choose how you're going to act. You're going to act one way or another. You could sit at home with your shoelaces untied, with your ass unwiped, eating Cheetos, watching reruns of Seinfeld, something like that. You could do that. But again, I could pose that question back to you. Why? Why do that? Why not tie your shoelaces? Why not wipe your ass? Why not put down the bag of Cheetos? And why not get up off your ass, off the couch, and go do something good for the world? Why not? There's no reason not to. just as there is no reason to do it. Reason is a function of the mind, and existence is beyond that. The fact is that there are no reasons. Nevertheless, values and principles still matter. This is the paradox of non-duality. Yes, existentially speaking, values are arbitrary, and there is no good and evil. But there's also the practical level. Don't get so enlightened or so caught up with non-duality that you forget about the practical, trivial level, where it does matter how you act, it does matter how you think, it does matter what values and principles you hold. And this is not moralizing. Someone might say, but Leo, you've ranted in the past about not moralizing and how there are no shoulds. And now it seems like you're telling me that I should be this good, upstanding, saintly person. Why should I do that? There's no reason why you should. If you don't want to be a good, standing, upstanding person, a decent human being, I'm not going to be here, standing here, convincing you that you're wrong or that you're evil. You're not. That's your choice. You can do that if you want to. But you know what? True goodness doesn't come from obligation or from reasons why you should be good. It comes spontaneously just from the fact that you understand that this is what a high consciousness being does. And that's different from moralization. I'm not telling you should be anyway. I'm telling you, you have the option to do whatever you want in life. You can play the game however you want. So the question is, how will you choose to play the game once you've realized that it is just a game? And remember that karma still applies. Actions still have consequences. If you say that nothing matters, does that mean that you're okay with me raping your grandma? You cool with that? If I rape your grandma? Or maybe you're not that cool with that. Maybe you don't like that idea. If you don't like that idea, then maybe you should have a rule or should have a principle that says that raping people, that's something that's low consciousness that I don't want to do. I'm not going to do it, and then hopefully other people won't do it. And then you know what? Hey, all of a sudden we got a social contract. A social contract where now all of a sudden we can have a decent community of people who aren't worried about everybody raping each other. See? Because your actions have consequences. They have consequences. And if you sit on the couch eating your Cheetos, that's going to have consequences. So no matter what you do, there will be consequences. See? This is why these sort of mystical non-dual teachings have been kept secret for centuries. And they have been esoteric. One of the reasons why is because it's been done to prevent abuse. People who do a sloppy form of non-duality can easily become Zen devils, can abuse it to do all sorts of evil and harm. And in fact, they can become extremely dangerous once they become enlightened, and yet they still have weak values and little compassion for other people. They can use their new non-dual insights to justify any kind of actions whatsoever. They can rape somebody. They can murder somebody. They can raise an army of crusaders and go conquering other religions. They can start their own religion. You know, they can do all sorts of stuff that has led to a lot of damage in the past, that leads to a lot of suffering. And you are not truly enlightened until you can have compassion for the suffering that everyone around you is experiencing. You might say, well, I'm enlightened now, I don't suffer anymore. You might not suffer anymore, but how about that little kid who's not enlightened yet and you see him suffering? How about your mom, who will never maybe be enlightened, and you see her suffering? How about your community, They as a whole might not be enlightened for another 10,000 years, and yet you see them suffering. And as a part of non-duality, you see that all these things are not separate from you. They are you. They're literally you. Your mom, that little kid, that community that you're a part of, even the community you're not a part of. It's all you. Do you have compassion for all that? Are you going to lead your life in an ecological, sustainable manner? Or are you going to be a Zen devil? I do not want to create Zen devils with my work. All of my work, everything I teach, should never be interpreted as a weapon to be used against other people, other traditions, other religions, other ideologies, other non-dual teachers, family members, friends, co-workers, assholes, evil people. None of this that I'm saying is to be used against them. It's only to be used to embody non-duality in your own life, to take responsibility for everything, to live a conscious life, to strive for that, to have values and principles that are in line with higher consciousness. That's what I want this work used for. Because, man, if history has taught us anything, it's just how easy it is to take this work and to twist it around. Because the ego loves to twist stuff around. You twist it around, you become a Zen devil, you backwards rationalize why you're not a Zen devil, and then you go out there and run amok in the world. And it's even more sad when an enlightened person does that. You would think that only unenlightened people could behave that way. No. What history shows us is that even very enlightened people can behave that way. Very enlightened people can be assholes, can be rapists, can be cult leaders. So keep that in mind. And don't become a Zen devil. And also, don't dismiss the value of common sense and goodness. I would much rather be surrounded by a group of common sense and decent human beings who know nothing at all about enlightenment than a bunch of people who are all enlightened but have no common sense and no goodness inside of them. All right? So there is work for you to do here, even if you're not enlightened yet. And sometimes people think like, well, Leo, so you're talking about this lofty enlightenment thing, and it seems like all this other work that I'm doing is just a waste. It's just a waste. Why should I work on this part of my life? Why should I care about my relationships? Because all I need to do is just reach for enlightenment, and then I got it all. And that's a fallacy. It's not going to happen that way. The psychological work you're doing now, the very basic personal development stuff, taking care of your finances, taking care of your relationships, working on your career, finding your life purpose, rearranging your values so that you're clear about those, that's all very good stuff. And if you're a kind of person who already has caring and compassion inside of them, even though you're not enlightened yet, that's awesome. That's great. Enlightenment can take that to the next level. But still, build up that goodness and that compassion within and practice it on a daily level. You don't need to wait till you're enlightened until you practice it. You can start practicing it now. And you're going to start to see the rewards and payoffs now, not later. It's going to help you with your suffering. It's going to help you with your emotions. It's going to help you with the success. It's going to help you with the people you attract in your life and so forth. So the bottom line is that this is a nuanced topic. And there are many traps here. Very many traps. And the traps are found on both sides. There's this extreme here and there's that extreme there, and you got to find that perfect balance in between. That's why true masters are so rare, because most people get seduced into one trap or another and never walk that narrow road long enough to really see the full fruition of non-duality, which is what I want for you. So that's it. I'm signing off. Post me your comments down below. Please click the like button also for me. Share this episode with a friend. And lastly, come check out my newsletter right here at actualize.org. sign up to the newsletter and just stay tuned with all the updates that I'll be sending out every single week as I release new content and I help you to navigate all the various traps. And I'm not helping you to navigate these traps from the standpoint of like, I'm the master, I know everything. No, it's from the standpoint of I'm on this journey with you. I'm walking the path. I'm seeing all these traps. Some of these traps I fall into myself. Sometimes I can do wild fox Zen. I'm aware of that trap. I can fall into that trap. Sometimes I can be a bit of a Zen devil too. I'm aware of that trap. So as I'm seeing these traps, I love sharing them with you because it'll help you to walk that path. So stay tuned for more, and I'll see you soon.